And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. It's inevitable. Whenever there is a mass shooting, the conversation eventually turns to mental illness. Surveys show that about half of the American public believes that mental illness is to blame for these shootings, but experts say the truth is more nuanced, that there's less of a link than you might expect. We'll hear from a local journalist and progressive activist who lives with mental illness, and we'll talk with a couple of experts about why the link between gun violence and mental illness persists, as well as the damage it does to people who have genuine mental health issues. But we begin with an update on the shootings in El Paso and Dayton this month and how those tragedies are changing the conversation or not around gun violence in America. Our first guest is Herman Lopez. He is a senior correspondent at Vox, where he covers criminal justice, guns, and drug policy. Herman, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks all for having me.
So let's begin by defining our terms. What exactly or how do you define a mass shooting, and how many of them have we had in America this year?
So I should say that there's no widely accepted definition for this. Generally, there's two competing, I would say, definitions. One is that an event in which a shooter kills four or more people, and then there's also one where it's just if the shooter shot four or more people, they weren't necessarily killed. And for both of these, the casualty tolls usually exclude the shooter himself or herself, but it's usually himself. And depending on that, depending on which definition you use, if you use a stricter definition, there have maybe been dozens of mass shootings this year. If you use the less strict definition, then we're talking about hundreds.
Wow. Well, and by that definition, we had one here in Philadelphia just last week. Six of our officers were shot. Herman, in the immediate aftermath of the shootings in Texas and Ohio, as you know, President Trump and many others expressed a desire for what they called meaningful background check legislation. What's happened to that since?
Since then, it seems like the president has mostly backed off. The report suggests that he got a call from NRA leadership, and they insisted that they do not want him to focus on expanded background checks. And as has happened before, Trump seemed to just pull the plug on this. He's no longer really focused on background checks and instead has been emphasizing mental illness as the problem here.
So a couple of questions about that then, because you mentioned the phone call with Wayne LaPierre, the chief executive of the NRA. Do you think that after that conversation, there is any reason to believe that there will be some sort of movement on gun safety when Congress comes back next month?
I think the one thing we might see in terms of gun safety is the red flag law, which these are laws that essentially let police, if somebody's reported by, say, family or police themselves or friends or peers, the police can come in and take somebody's guns temporarily. So something like that might happen at the federal level. The federal government might encourage states to adopt those laws. That's something that some Republicans have been talking about. But otherwise, it seems very unlikely that much will happen.
I'd like you to break that down a little bit, because some states do already have red flag laws in effect. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
So how many have them, and sort of what's the success rate been?
Well, it kind of, I can't think of the number off my head, but I think the success rate has, like, the research so far has shown that they're really strong for preventing suicides. That's one of the big things that they're helpful for. And there was one study that came out in the past week that suggested that they help the California version of the law might have helped prevent some mass shootings. Mm-hmm. Just based on that, they seized weapons from people who threatened mass shootings, and those people never went on to commit any kind of atrocity or anything like that. Now, the researchers say they can't prove 100% that these were all prevented deaths, but I mean, this is suggestive evidence that these laws are working essentially as expected.
So in the states that have these kinds of laws, is it family members who can express that concern and try to sort of get the ball rolling to have weapons taken away? Is it law enforcement? Is it a combination? How does it work?
It varies from state to state. Some states have looser standards and some states have stricter ones. There's also a question of whether just how quickly the weapons can be seized. If the courts can demand an emergency hearing and take a person's weapons away very quickly. The concern with that, particularly on the gun rights side, is that kind of lowers the evidence bar for seizing somebody's guns in an emergency hearing. So beyond just whether a police or family member is the one reporting it, there's also a question of just how quickly the guns can be seized.
One of the concerns that I read about as it relates to the red flag laws is communication, that there tends to be, obviously, better results in states where there's an intentional effort to communicate that the laws exist. Some people don't even know that the law's in place.
Right. This is true even in fairly liberal states like California. From city to city, it depends on just whether people are aware of the law or whether law enforcement are making an effort to actually tell people, hey, this is a law that exists and you can report your family members. You should report these kinds of incidents to us. And more broadly, this is something we've seen with mass shootings. There are, even without red flag laws, there are sometimes like these kinds of red flags pop up and nobody reports them because they don't know that they're worth reporting essentially to the police.
Hmm. I want to circle back, Herman, to the NRA conversation that we had a moment ago, because the NRA itself has been in some trouble lately. Can you sort of summarize for us what's been going on with the NRA of late?
So lately they've been having some they've been under investigation for some financial situations. There have been a lot of media reports about how the NRA might be essentially abusing its nonprofit status. The leadership might be abusing it for personal gain, personal financial gain. There's also been some, like, for example, NRA TV shut down because the NRA does seem to be having serious financial issues. But beyond that, there's also just been like some sort of civil war, is how this press has widely described it, between some of the leadership. There seems to be some philosophical disagreement between how they should be approaching, for example, mass shootings and gun control and things like that. And we've seen that some major leadership has stepped down, and it seems like right now the NRA is in a bit of shambles. Like it doesn't seem to be like it used to be. The most powerful gun lobby organization in the U.S., and right now it seems kind of astray.
So will the dysfunction that you're describing ultimately weaken the NRA in any way, do you think?
I mean, if they work their issues out in the next few months, I don't see it happening. The NRA is such a powerful organization. It has so many members, too, and it has so much buy-in with the Republican Party in particular already. It's hard to imagine that they would just go out. If they don't fix their issues within the next few months, and these continue for like months and maybe years, and you could start seeing the organization get weaker. But I would suspect that another gun rights organization, there are plenty of them out there in the U.S., would be trying to replace them.
In the aftermath of the shootings in Texas and Ohio, the Democratic presidential candidates were challenging Congress to return for an emergency session to work on gun legislation. That obviously did not happen, but talk a little bit about how the leading Democratic candidates are approaching this issue in their campaigns.
So they're actually trying to take more, like, bolder solutions, I would say, than has been expected of the Democratic Party. For the past 25 years or so, the Democratic Party has generally focused on universal background checks and an assault weapons ban. That's generally been what they've been focused on since that's essentially what they did in the 90s. They passed a federal law regarding background checks and then a 10-year assault weapons ban. And since then, that's mostly been the focus. But recently, we've seen some Democrats like Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker start putting on proposals that also add licensing. So requiring a license to buy and own a gun. They usually compare this to like requiring a driver's license to drive a car. And then beyond that, their proposals do make some bigger changes in terms of like boosting enforcement or funding more gun research. But the big thing here is that they're starting to go beyond just background checks and an assault weapons ban.
So do you think that there is any hope of meaningful gun legislation? And I know you talked about the red flag laws possibly getting some traction, but do you think that anything meaningful will happen before the 2020 election?
It's hard to see it happen, besides a red flag law, which I think would have some impact, but it's hard to imagine it. Anything else, anything bigger happening. Republicans and Republican aides on the Hill have just been saying repeatedly that they need President Trump to give like a clear message if he wants expanded background checks, but that just doesn't seem to be happening.
So getting back to the mental health conversation, the president went so far this week as to suggest reopening mental institutions to house people that he called deranged and dangerous. He even used the term mentally ill monsters and talked about getting them off the streets and said that they should be involuntarily confined in order to prevent more mass shootings. What did you make of those remarks?
I think one thing is I've talked to a lot of experts for this, and I personally have family and friends who have mental health issues. And just that phrase, mentally ill monsters, is the exact kind of stigmatizing language that people want to avoid in these conversations. Because, yes, these are not people who are committing mass shootings. Like, obviously, they're not good people, and we're, like a lot of people are hurt and angry at them, but it just seems to me like when you start using sweeping language like that, and when you start suggesting that they, like that othering language, should be involuntary confined and all that, it starts getting into the territory where we're not just talking about providing mental health care for these people to prevent these shootings, but kind of stigmatizing them.
Yeah. We'll be talking quite a bit more about that as the show goes on with some of our other guests, Herman. But I think it's important to point out that it was, I believe, shortly after the president was elected that he rolled back some legislation from the Obama presidency that made it more difficult for people with mental illness to get guns. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The Obama administration, sort of toward the end of its second term, passed these regulations that essentially said, just made it harder for people to, who had mental health issues and they were caught up in the federal system. I believe it was the Social Security Administration. Like, if somebody had clear mental health issues and there were a few checks in place, they would have a harder time buying a firearm. And the Trump administration, it's one of the first things they rolled back.
So there was a way of at least identifying people who could potentially be a risk, at least. But now we're not able to identify those folks.
Right. And this has been a constant challenge with the federal background check system. It is supposed to prohibit people with serious mental illnesses from obtaining guns. But the reporting for that system has been so spotty. The states don't often report these cases. The records that are reported are often missing. They're usually focused, for example, on like public institutions. So if somebody goes to a private hospital to get mental health care, they might not show up in the system at all. And these are big gaps. And if you believe that there should be prohibitions based on mental illness, that should concern you, because that means a lot of people are falling through the cracks. I actually, interestingly, had this Massachusetts police chief complain about the system in the way that it was deemed unfair to people who are more reliant on public systems. Like, in a way, it's class discrimination, because somebody who is wealthy and goes to, say, Harvard, like a Harvard hospital for mental health care, doesn't show up in the system, whereas somebody who would show up in a public institution would. And that just seems it's kind of an unfair disparity there.
Yeah, and the Harvard person may be as likely or even more likely perhaps to be a danger, but yet we don't have a way of knowing that. In our last 40 seconds or so, Herman, before we have to say goodbye, bring us up to speed on whatever is new with the shootings in El Paso and Dayton. What else have we learned recently about that, or what's the update?
Essentially, the investigations are ongoing, but we do know now that the El Paso, the shooter was still, as originally reported, that he did seem to have some white supremacist beliefs. And with the Dayton shooter, it's actually been less clear. We haven't gotten that many answers. One thing that I'm worried about is, in our search for motivations, sometimes we just don't find good answers. We saw that in the Las Vegas shooting, where literally hundreds of people were injured and dozens were killed. And it's concerning that we might never know why some of these shooters do what they do.
Mm. Herman, thank you so much. Herman Lopez is a senior correspondent at Vox. We have to say goodbye, but thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
When we come right back, we'll be talking about the link or not between mental illness and gun violence. Radio Times will be back in just a moment. And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the link, or not, between mental illness and gun violence. President Trump has been strongly suggesting that such a link exists, and surveys show that at least half of Americans agree. Mental health experts beg to differ, though, saying that the research just doesn't bear it out. If mental illness is not a significant factor in gun violence, what is? To help answer that question and more, we have two guests. Dr. John Jack Rosell is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Adjunct Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh. And Dr. Dominic Sisti is Assistant Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy and Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania and Director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics in Behavioral Healthcare. That is quite a mouthful. Dr. Sisti, welcome to you both to Radio Times.
Thanks, Tracy.
So, Dr. Sisti, I will begin with you. I think it's important to define our terms in this conversation. How do we define mental illness?
It's a great question, and it's a question that's puzzled psychiatry now for decades, if not centuries. Mental illnesses are a diverse group of syndromes that cause distress in individuals, psychic distress in individuals that is often rooted in some cases, chemical imbalances of neurotransmitters in the brain. In the most clear cases, we see mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder responding to different kinds of medications. These are disorders that detach a person from reality for a time, often through delusions, or they have what are called negative symptoms in the case of schizophrenia, like depression, withdrawal, and serious anxiety. Then there will be positive symptoms like hallucinations and beliefs about paranoid beliefs about, say, the government trying to take your guns, for example, might be one. So there are diverse kinds of mental illnesses. To refer to mental illness as a sort of homogenous concept is wrong. It's much like cancer, where there's dozens and dozens of different kinds of mental illnesses, ranging from less severe to very severe. We tend to focus in our society on the least, severe types of mental illnesses. Not that they're good or positive things like, everyday depression and things like this. These are the common colds of mental illnesses. But there are about 2-3% of the population that do experience or have serious mental illnesses, which are defined by the NIMH as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression.
Dr. Jack Rosell, before I go into the next question, anything you'd like to add as we're talking about how we define mental illness?
That's really the nexus of the issue here is how do we identify who is mentally ill? What is the term that we're going to use to describe it? A lot of people who engage in violence, a lot of people who engage in mass violence, are they, quote unquote, healthy? Probably not. Do they meet the formal criteria for a psychiatric disorder? Far more often than not, they do not meet those criteria. Our best data says probably 5% or so of violence in general in our society can be tied back to mental illness or people with mental illness. And although there's a lot of variability in the studies, as best as we can tell when it comes to mass shootings, it's only a minority of those events that can be tied back to mental illness.
And Dominic Sisti, some might suggest that the very act of walking into a building and shooting people up mm-hmm. could be considered mental illness. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, so I think if you define your definition of killing other people as intrinsically mentally ill, then any murder is could be chalked up to a mental illness. I mean, the fact is, people do horrible things. People can be evil and not mentally ill. And, unless we're going to say the 9/11 hijackers were mentally ill, I think rightly named their actions as what they were, which was frankly just evil. So I think, trying to essentially pack the argument or beg the central question here by saying, violence is intrinsically a phenomenon of mental illness is circular.
Dr. Jack Rosell, since so few mass shooters survive the event, how do we really know, in terms of doing the research and trying to get a handle on whether mental illness was present, how do we know in a way that we can be confident about what their mental health was?
So we have a number of different studies or case series that have looked at mass shootings, and they've come up with a couple different numbers about what's the likelihood that this person has had some type of identified or identifiable psychiatric illness during or prior to this event. Most of the data points to about 1 in 4 of these offenders had a known or identified psychiatric illness prior to the event. By the way, that's pretty much what we expect in the general population. If you walk down the street, walk down the hallway of your office, probably about 1 in 4 folks is living with a psychiatric illness. So when we hear this number being associated with the number of people engaging in mass violence with mental illness, I don't get very excited about it. How do we know? We do detailed reviews of these people. We look at their lives, their life histories. We look at data sets that come to people who are able to access a lot more records than the average layperson, like reports from the FBI, the Secret Service, major law enforcement organizations. And when they do the deep dives, they find, 1 in 6, 1 in 4 of these folks have an identified psychiatric illness. One study that came out about a year ago looked at people who had engaged in mass shootings in public places, and then they went back and said, how many of these folks had severe psychiatric illness, so severe that they would have met criteria for exclusion from purchase under the NICS, the National Fire and Background Check System. And only about 5% of those folks actually would have met criteria. As an emergency psychiatrist, as someone who's going to go back to the crisis center this afternoon to see folks, what I need to know is, does this person sitting in front of me, if I had seen them before they went on to do some type of terrible event, would they have had something that I recognize? This is a diagnosis. This is something I can treat. And by the way, maybe this is something that might meet criteria for inpatient admission or involuntary commitment. By and large, the people who go on and engage in some of these terrible acts don't even come close to that threshold.
Dr. Dominic Sisti, the president has said repeatedly that mental illness is to blame in mass shootings. He has talked about how mental illness and hate pull the trigger, not the gun. And others in leadership positions have said similar things. How does that help or hurt the conversation around mental illness and gun violence?
So, you know, I think we need to be sure we're talking about, you know, the same issue here, which is mass violence. You know, there's different kinds of violence. Mass violence is a distinct category of violence. Other kinds of violence, like intimate partner violence, for example, there is a higher correlation there between mental illness and that form of violence. But mass shooting violence, as Dr. Rizal has been saying, is really an outlier for mentally ill people to commit. So when he makes such claims, it's obvious he doesn't really understand the epidemiology or the public health research on this. And so it's hurtful in that, you know, we need evidence-based policies to fix this problem. So creating policies that are not evidence-based, in fact, are actually the antithesis of what would be evidence-based. That's a big problem. Then, as Herman and you described earlier, there is this issue of stigma, which means that now individuals with mental illness are looked upon as violent or dangerous. This will cause self-stigma, which is bad, but also will create a dynamic in which individuals who do have serious mental illnesses might be hesitant to seek out treatment for fear of being criminalized.
And Jack Rizal, I have read that actually people with mental illnesses are more likely to be victimized than to victimize others. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. I want to read a comment. We've got several comments, actually, from our listeners. This one comes from Beth, who says, most people who have a mental illness are victims, not perpetrators of violence. My brother has lived with schizophrenia for over 40 years, 20 of which he spent in a state mental hospital. His schizophrenia is now under control, but he still suffers from the long-term impact of institutionalization. And she closes it by saying, once again, Trump is clueless. We have another comment here from Cynthia. It's an email. And Cynthia says, I am beyond sick and tired of mental illness constantly being used as a scapegoat. While some shooters may be mentally ill, many of them are operating out of pure hatred. I think that's an interesting point because a lot of what I have read has suggested that, you know, the linkage is small when it comes to mass shooting and mental illness, that for a lot of mass shooters, it's not so much mental illness, it's hatred, it's rage, it's jealousy, it's a lot of the pathologies that a lot of us, Dominic Sisti, experience in our own lives day to day.
Yeah, I mean, not obviously to the degree, but these are, you know, common features among, you know, usually young white male shooters. They're hateful bigots. They're domestic terrorists, essentially. And so, yeah, I agree with the comment that mental illness is often a convenient scapegoat. You know, the ideologies that have been, I think, promoted and disseminated via social media, specifically Twitter, and other outlets have created an echo chamber for the kind of hatred that motivates shooters like the one in El Paso. And frankly, a lot of that rhetoric comes straight from the White House. And that's really the scary part.
And Jack Rizal, the problem is that you can go to a diagnostic manual and you're not going to see racism or white supremacy or some of the factors that have been identified to be motivating factors for these shooters. That doesn't sort of fall within the diagnostic criteria.
Yeah, we don't have a diagnosis for racism, for anti-Semitism, for misogyny, for sadism. If we could, you know, there's a part of me that almost says, gosh, I almost wish there was more of an intersection with mental illness. I'd feel like as a psychiatrist I could do more, but that simply isn't the reality. And over again in this dialogue, what I want to be able to do is I want to be able to identify people at risk, prior to the events to be able to stop some of these events. And it turns out that if you're trying to handle that big object of prevention of violence, if you're only grabbing onto the issue of psychiatric diagnosis, while there is a role for psychiatric diagnosis and psychiatric illness, it's a very weak handle. It's a very small intersection. We've got to get it right, but it's not a big intersection.
Let me remind our listeners of the ways that they can participate in our conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dominic Sisti, I was reading an article just yesterday about Health and Human Services staffers who expressed the feeling of being muzzled, if you will, because there was a directive that was issued to them not to post anything that would contradict the president's assertion that mental illness is to blame for the shootings Texas and Ohio. And as a mental health expert, and I would put this question to you as well, Jack Rosell, how concerned are you about that?
Oh, very much. It sort of reminded me of the miniseries Chernobyl, where everybody was muzzled about talking about the actual catastrophe. We are experiencing a catastrophe in our country. We need experts, public health researchers, psychiatrists, policy experts to be doing the job that they're trained to do. And if that means speaking out publicly to educate the public, they should be able to do that. There should be no political motivation here in muzzling experts on this issue at all. It's frightening. It indicates a slide into something that I don't think we've seen in this country before. That worries me very much.
Jack Rosell, what do you say?
Yeah. Certainly for, over 20 years, we've had the issue of just a lack of funded research from the government around firearm injury prevention. The added step of specifically telling subject matter experts within our major, governmental institutions to zip it, to not talk about this. Yeah, I agree that that's a terrifying step. But again, we got to be clear that for a couple decades now, we have not put the funding or the infrastructure in place to better understand how to prevent firearm injuries across our country. The United States has a firearm homicide rate that's 25 times that of other economically developed countries. We have a firearm suicide rate that's 10 times other economically developed countries. It's a staggering ratio. And we actually do have a lot of very good research, and we need to use the good evidence that's out there. But we also know that we're spending about 1 cent on the dollar compared to other major causes of death and injury. We're only getting about 1% of the peer-reviewed publications into the scientific literature as other similar causes of death and injury. So, yeah, we need to improve our research. And telling subject matter experts and policy leaders to zip it does not help the dialogue at all.
Well, you also bring up such an interesting point there, because one of the things that I read was that when you look at other countries, the rate of mental illness in the population is similar to ours, and yet the rate of mass shootings here is just off the charts relative to other countries.
This is an American problem. We do not see mass shootings like this in any other economically developed country. We don't see mass violence on this scale, except in countries that are in active states of war. This is a legacy that our children will grow up with. This is an environment that we've created, and it's a massive public health threat.
I want to bring in Steve to our conversation. Steve is calling from Newtown. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yeah, great program. Had a long career as a mental health professional, retired now. I was also chief of mental health for a couple of prisons at two different times in my career. I know a lot about violence. I know a lot about these characters and these mass shootings, and this goes for rapists and pedophiles too. They don't have mental health histories. And if this conversation just ended with, let's not pursue mental health screening, and it's unfair to people with mental illness because they're not the ones that do these shootings, that would be fine with me. Stop picking on the mental health community. These people don't have mental health records. Where I would disagree with, to me, it's the most serious mental illness. It's access to pathology, antisocial, narcissistic personality disorders, who commit these crimes, including the sex offenders and mass shooters, but they're what we call egosyntonic. They feel themselves to be normal, so they're not going to go for treatment. Ergo, no mental health record. Ergo, don't be screening out mental health like the president suggested. It's going to do nothing. Let's not waste legislation on that. The problem will persist with these because they don't go to mental health because they feel themselves to be normal. But great program, and I totally support anything that helps the mental health patients, like depression, anxiety, et cetera. They're not the ones that, and even schizophrenics do not do these crimes. Like you said in your program, they're more likely to hurt themselves than other people.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for your call, and thank you for the work that you are doing in the area of mental health. Dominic Sisti, I'd like you to respond to
this. No, I mean, I think the caller's absolutely right. He has life experience. He's seen these individuals. He knows. The access to personality disorders, I think, do, in fact, influence some of these individuals. That, you know, we might even say psychopathy is something also we might use as an explanatory model. It's not a diagnosis. But, yeah, I mean, there are these egocentric syndromes or personality or character types that are angry often, feel like they've been victimized, and lash out. Tough to pick up those folks before they do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, the key issue here is gun availability. The fact that you can walk into a Walmart and buy a gun and walk out and shoot people. I mean, you know, a AR-15 that allows you to unload, you know, 10, 20 rounds in under a minute, that is a weapon of war. You know, we just don't need those in the public sphere. So to me, the ultimate question here is about it is not about mental health, mental illness. There are so many different variables that lead somebody to do these things. The ultimate common denominator here is access to weapons of war. If we can end or somehow curtail access to weapons of war, we'll see a decline in these types of incidents.
And that raises so many questions, because there is the concern that there are already so many out here.
Right.
You know, it's like the train has left the station in that respect. And so how do we dial that back? And I was reading, Dr. Sisti, that in America, we have now more guns than people.
That's right.
It was something like 400 million guns.
I think the statistic I most recently read was 1-to-1, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 400 million, something like, I think it was 120.5 per 100.
Yeah, about that, 1.2 to 1, yeah.
Something to that effect. So enormous number of guns. We have much more to talk about when Radio Times comes right back. We invite our listeners to call us at 888-477-9499. We're also going to be hearing from a former journalist, a progressive activist, someone who is living with mental illness and has much to say about the president's comments this past week and the linkage or not between mental illness and gun violence. And of course, we will continue with our mental health experts to explore this topic. So stick with us. Radio Times will be right back. And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We've been talking about gun violence and what experts would argue is a precarious link to mental illness. We have been talking with Jack Rozelle, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh, and Dominic Sisti, Assistant Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy and Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. We also have another guest here in the studio whose name many of our listeners may know. Ben Waxman is a former journalist, a union organizer, and most recently a spokesman for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. What our listeners may not know is that Ben knows a thing or two about mental illness. He is here to share his own struggle and his thoughts around the current conversation regarding mental illness and gun violence. Ben Waxman, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently wrote a piece in Philadelphia Magazine where you disclose that you yourself have struggled with a form of mental illness for most of your adult life. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, the conversation, it's something that I had thought about doing for a long time. And the conversation around mental health and gun violence, in particular mass shootings, had gotten a little bit unwieldy, it seemed to me. And so as this conversation was happening, in sort of the wake of these two really horrific events that happened in El Paso and also in Dayton, that it seemed to me that there was a lot of heat and not a lot of light happening as part of the conversation. Really, why I wrote the piece partially was to talk a little bit about the political rhetoric around mental health and gun violence, but also to try to, in some way, I want to say normalize it for people. I think that one of the things that has happened is that when you take something like mental health issues and then you put them next to mass shootings, you create sort of this sense of almost extreme way of thinking about the issues. And I think that one of the things that your guests have touched on throughout the show so far is that there really is a spectrum when it comes to mental health, and that people who suffer from mental health issues are not you know, necessarily going to be people who are dangerous or involved in shootings or a variety of other sort of antisocial and destructive behaviors, and that people who have behavioral health and mental health issues are everywhere in our society. They are in lots of different jobs and roles and positions and are able to have, you know, if you can have access to the kind of treatment that you need and you're able to do the things that you need to do to keep yourself on the right track and on healthy, you know, there aren't a whole lot of limits about what you can do. And I thought that the current way that people were talking about mental health really kind of went counter to that. And I wanted to share my own story in a way because I felt like it might be surprising to some people since I've held sort of different stressful and high-profile jobs over the years. But, you know, this is something that's been a part of my life since I was 18 or 19 years old. And so I wanted to talk about it so that people could get a sense that, you know, this is a spectrum. This is a wide variety of things. It's not just, you know, always the most extreme example in the way that the president has used it, and that to talk about it that way really creates a stigma for people that is both, you know, unnecessary and unhelpful and just a sort of distortion of reality.
Well, you mentioned that your struggle has been with bipolar, and you said that when the president talks about, hey, it's mental illness that pulls the trigger, he's talking about people like you.
Right. He's talking about a really, really broad category of people. There are 2 million people in adults in the United States that have the same sort of diagnosis that I do. There are many millions more that suffer from all kinds of things, from, you know, depression, other mood disorders, and you know, and so again, to paint with a really broad brush and to immediately make those links, I think sets a really, really bad tone for a conversation, not because it really avoids talking about other systemic issues in society like racism and sexism and other motivations for mass shootings and also other kinds of really destructive behaviors, but it also allows the president and perhaps some of his supporters to escape talking about some of those big, big, important things that could help us, you know, maybe stem the tide of some of these shootings.
I want to bring a caller into our conversation. Jeff has been holding on the line from Westchester. Jeff, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. First-time caller. I just wanted to mention also with the bipolar, I am actually diagnosed with bipolar. The one thing is if you're going to get treated, you actually want to live. You don't want to commit things. So if you're being treated, that's not where the problem is. The problem lies. They couldn't even speak to the government or anyone to say what I was even if I was bipolar or not. So I don't know how you would jump that hoop. And I would actually give my right to carry a gun if I could actually be guaranteed that I would have treatment for the rest of my life for my mental illness. The problem is, I get dropped, you have insurance, you don't have insurance. And one last point I wanted to make, which is maybe not 100% with it, is if somebody was from out of the country and they did a mass shooting, why are they not looked at as having mental illness and they are just a terrorist? Thank you.
Well, Jeff, thank you for your call. You've raised a number of interesting points there. Dominic, I don't know if you want to maybe take on any of those.
Well, I mean, I think it's, that was a great comment. You know, the first point about giving up one's right to a gun for treatment is really an interesting point. It shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't have to make such trade-offs in a country that has such wealth and prosperity. The fact is mental health care in our country has been neglected for half a century or more. It's always been neglected, frankly. And the idea that one would have to trade a constitutional right for treatment seems, is a shame. I mean, the idea here that folks who are treatment seeking, these are not the folks who are the problem, right? You know, most mentally ill individuals who are, you know, are open to feeling better. They're suffering. They're sick. They want to feel better. So we should help them feel better and live a fully fulfilling, happy, functional life. And that's possible in every case, frankly. This idea that, you know, mentally ill individuals should have to give up a right, you know, because they can't get treatment, you know, that premise is a shame. That's a bad thing. The second piece is, you know, the idea that an individual with a serious mental illness will be viewed upon as violent. And that's a problem. I mean, we, as Ben was describing, you know, folks live with these illnesses, and Ben has been courageous enough to describe his own in really high-functioning capacities. These are not violent individuals. So the rhetoric coming out of the White House is yet another example of divisive rhetoric. It's like basically a metaphorical wall this president is trying to build with another group of Americans. And that to me is just abhorrent.
You raised a point, and it's come up a couple of times, and I think it bears sort of chasing down, and that is about access to treatment. And you wrote, Ben Waxman, in your piece, that you have been fortunate to have access to good treatment, and that has really helped you to hold down these high-profile jobs and to function at a very high level in spite of the bipolar. But the fact remains that access is difficult for a lot of people. And Jack Rozell, I'd like you to talk about this, that, you know, for most people, if you have a migraine, you can go to the doctor and you can get a prescription and you have a copay or whatever it might look like. For someone who has mental health issues, if your insurance doesn't cover that, it's very, very expensive to get quality treatment.
So under the Affordable Care Act, actually, we had this concept of parity, that I would get as many benefits for behavioral health issues as I would for my physical health issues. Now, there's been a big push to take a lot of the resources out of current healthcare coverage, including taking away this concept of parity. That's a concern. By the way, a lot of the people pushing to take out parity from our health insurance system are the same people who are pointing fingers incorrectly at mental illness as a cause of violence. Now, what I would suggest, no matter where one lies on the gun rights versus gun control debate, wouldn't it be wonderful if it was as easy, as destigmatized, as socially acceptable, as profitable to the provider and affordable to the person trying to acquire to get your hands on a good therapist, a good outpatient mental health clinic, as it is to get your hands on a firearm? You know, it was mentioned earlier, we have, according to one study, 393 million firearms in civilian hands in the U.S. That's more than the next 39 countries combined.
Wow.
A violence prevention strategy that focuses exclusively on getting rid of all of these firearms without recognizing the Second Amendment and everything that goes with that is going to be doomed to failure. But also a strategy that says we just need more guns, the whole armed society is a polite society myth. You know, I don't think we're going to get 425 million firearms and all of a sudden our violence rates are going to drop. That's just not going to happen. Every study we've looked at seems to point towards more guns equals more gun violence, including suicide, including homicide, and as rare as they are, including mass shootings. Mm-hmm.
Dominic Sisti, what do you have to say about that regarding access?
No, I agree. A colleague, Isabel Pereira, and I just published a paper recently in which we looked at the amount of firearms in the U.S. and mass shootings in the U.S. compared to other countries that deinstitutionalized, because the president, of course, had said we want to open up these psychiatric hospitals to stop mass shootings. We showed that argument, that claim, was patently false. As Dr. Rozell described, other countries have similar rates of mental disorders, mental illness, populations with schizophrenia, bipolar, major depression, these serious mental illnesses, no mass shootings. So, and they also deinstitutionalized. They don't have psychiatric beds. So same level of psychiatric care in terms of inpatient capacity, but no mass shootings. There is no direct correlation there. So for the president to go out and say we need to build psychiatric institutions to stop mass shootings, again, not evidence-based and almost like a sort of rhetorical flourish that has no grounding in reality.
I want to read a tweet from Alan, who says the language that POTUS has used in conjunction with involuntary committing is eerily reminiscent of 1936 Germany. Gun violence is multifactorial, but demonizing those suffering from mental health issues does not begin to address this scourge.
So, let's put it this way. This president is the last president I would want to set up a system that confines a certain group of people. Let's leave it there.
Yeah. Well, they're doing that.
They're doing that.
Right. Yeah. I did want to come back to something that you said earlier about being lucky enough to have access to care. I think that it's important just to make a clear distinction that it's not just about luck. It's about privilege, right? So, it's about having access to quality health care. It's about having access to the support systems that people need. And we just know for a fact that in our society, that there's a tremendous amount of discrimination sort of baked into the healthcare system towards all kinds of marginalized people. And so, when I look back at my own life and I think about what I've been through and the things that I've been able to accomplish, it has to be with a recognition of like my own privilege that allowed me to be able to stand here and have this conversation and talk about it. And I think that that's something that if we're talking about these issues has to be front and center as a part of the conversation, as not only dealing with, you know, treating mental health, but treating the disparities and inequities in a society broadly. And there's, and that's why, again, just simply saying, oh, you know, you can blame mass shootings on people who have mental health problems or any other kind of antisocial or destructive behavioral mental health issues, it kind of lets you, allows you to just kind of cop out and not think about all of, you know, the various dimensions and pieces that lead to people, you know, being marginalized and not having access to the kind of treatment that they need. And the only way, you know, to handle that, to deal with those issues, is to talk about real, you know, plans to figure out how to make our society more equal and equitable.
Yeah. Well, and that brings up another point, and there's another line of thinking since you're talking about privilege. There is a line of thinking that says that when we're talking about these kinds of issues, that and we talk about mental health, if the perpetrator is white, oftentimes we will say something about mental health. Mm-hmm. If they're a person of color, now we start talking about criminality, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that line of thinking that's out there.
Yeah, no, I think that that's the trend that you see, and it's rooted, again, in, you know, these bigotry and racist ideologies around certain kinds of people being certain ways, overgeneralized by and amplified by the president himself. And it's dangerous and it's destructive.
Yeah. Question from Kyle, an email question. How is this narrative guided by the fact that the CDC can't promote research on guns and crime? And could this restriction on research be litigated? Any thoughts about that?
Maybe Jack could comment on that, yeah. But I do agree. I mean, I think this is something that's haunted us now for decades, that we can't actually do the scientific social science research that is necessary to unpack some of these policy ideas and see how well they work. There's a reason why CDC has been muzzled on research. Why is that? Well, it's because the findings will not serve the purpose of gigantic lobbying groups and politicians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, we see the interference by politicians in sound public health science.
Jack Rozelle, what do you say?
In the long term, given the scale and the scope of the firearm injury issue in our country, increasing research and increasing evidence-based policy will be our best intervention. It's a slow road, but it's the best chance we have to actually get this issue under control.
Hmm. Another question from Luann, who says, why isn't the American Psychiatric Association speaking out about this?
Well, they are, right? I mean, the Psychiatric Association, I've just seen a lot of statements post these, you know, a couple of weeks ago when there were these dual mass shootings that happened over that Saturday. I saw a lot of healthcare professionals speaking out and psychiatric professionals speak out. I mean, different associations have been releasing statements. I think the medical community has been pretty robust in their response to a lot of this. And I think that that's been something that's been heartening to see. So I don't know if maybe I'm missing this particular association, but I feel like there's been a lot of people who are experts and who are medical professionals and are very, very familiar with these issues that have been willing to say, you know, this is not the right way to talk about this, and this is not the right way to think about this. And I think, you know, we should be grateful for that.
Yeah. Dominic Sisti, in our last 60 seconds or so of this conversation, what would you like listeners to come away from this conversation with?
So the bottom line here is that mental illness does play a small role in forms of mass violence. It is not the predominant driver of such violence. Bigotry, hatred, feelings of victimization, et cetera, are often at the forefront of these kinds of mass shootings. To me, the ethical challenge here as a society is to decide, do we want to allow our children to live in what is essentially becoming a war zone, or do we want to enact common sense reforms like banning assault weapons and instituting background checks and red flag laws? That's the trade-off. Do we want our kids to live in a peaceful society with rational laws and policies or not?
Yeah. I think that's a powerful question for all of us to think about. It's time to say goodbye, but I want to thank all of you so much. Dr. Dominic Sisti from the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Jack Rozelle from the University of Pittsburgh, Ben Waxman here in Philadelphia. Thanks to all of you for helping us to expand the conversation around mental illness and gun violence in America. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you.
Our producers today have been John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineer is Al Banks. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and you have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.